Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's unexpected death on Saturday underscores what observers have known for decades. He left an indelible mark on American law. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Appointed to the High Court in 1986, this only son of an Italian immigrant college professor and an elementary school teacher was a stellar student and champion debater long before he ever arrived at Harvard Law School. Scalia's influential originalist interpretation of the Constitution made him a towering figure in contemporary conservative thought. He was also a devout Catholic, devoted husband and father to 9 children, and a lover of opera, an interest that drew him into a warm friendship with fellow Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, despite their radically different views on the interpretation of the Constitution. To be sure, Scalia loved to argue and so brilliantly crafted his opinions that some of his staunchest ideological opponents admired and even envied his style. It was Scalia's capacity as a writer in which he came to befriend attorney, lexicographer, and author Brian Garner. They co-authored the books Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges, and Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Texts, and just this month returned home from a trip together to Hong Kong and Singapore. Brian Garner is here to tell us about his dear friend and colleague. Brian, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
I realize this loss was personal to you. As well as professional. So I first want to extend my condolences. This had to have come as a shock, despite the fact that Justice Scalia was very close to his 80th birthday.
Well, he certainly didn't look 80, and he didn't act 80, whatever that is. He was very robust and very strong, and we spent 12 days of his last 3 weeks together in Asia, and we were... We took a helicopter tour of Hong Kong. We did a walking tour of both Singapore and Hong Kong, and he was as strong as ever.
How did you meet and decide to write together?
Well, it's probably the most unlikely friendship ever. In 2006, by that point, I had been teaching CLE seminars, continuing legal education seminars all over the country for 15 years. And I was beginning to incorporate film clips of judges, famous judges, state and federal. And I hadn't interviewed any U.S. Supreme Court justices, but I'd interviewed some 170 other judges. And I wrote to Justice Scalia suggesting we do an interview. He said, "No, Mr. Garner, I will not interview you or do an interview with you, but I do know something about your views on legal writing, and I would like to have breakfast with you next time you're in Washington." So we met in June 2006 for the first time. We hit it off almost immediately. I talked him into an interview over the course of that breakfast in Georgetown. And then on October 2nd, 2006, we did our interview. And that was only our second meeting, and I had the temerity to suggest that we should do a book together, and he accepted.
How did one convince Justice Antonin Scalia of anything he didn't want to do?
Well, he was a very persuadable man. I mean, I found...
Really?
Yes, yes. He would tell audiences, and we made, I don't know, 35 appearances together where we would team teach. He would tell audiences that most of the time when he and I began disagreeing on some point, a majority of the time he came around to my point of view. And I think that that was true. But before that happened, he would hit me very hard. I mean, I would get a blast of an email, and he would say, "I absolutely disagree with you on this." But if I had something good coming back, I found him to be very persuadable. And so what we shared was a love of language, a love of rhetoric, a love of clear exposition and clear thinking. And, of course, a lot of people misunderstand Justice Scalia, I think, by somehow equating his methods of decision-making just with the votes that were delivered as opposed to the reasoning involved. And I think that's something that is frequently lost. People talk about how passionate he was. Well, he was passionate about the American form of government and about the separation of powers. And he didn't care so much about, I think he did care about good policy, but it's not as if a vote cast this way or that way is the most important thing a justice does. A justice's lasting impact is through clear judicial writing.
You can't judge judges unless you know what they're working with. Simply because you like the outcome of an opinion, you say, oh, that's a good judge, or you dislike and you say, that's it. Unless you want your judges to ignore the text that they're dealing with, and we're always dealing with a text. It's either a regulation or a statute or the Constitution. Unless you want them to ignore the text, it's really unfair to judges to say, I like the result, therefore that's a good judge. I hate the result, therefore that's a bad judge. You have to read the opinion and see the sections of the statute they're dealing with, trying to reconcile and whatnot. And then you can say, the guy did a terrible job of interpreting this statute. That's an intelligent criticism.
That was Justice Antonin Scalia speaking to C-SPAN. I want to.
And
talk...
you would almost think, by the way, that I was setting that up.
Right, you did not know we had this.
I had no idea. Yeah,
you did not know we had this guy. I want to talk about his take on the Constitution. How did he formulate his conviction that his duty as a Supreme Court justice was to render opinions according to the intentions of the framers in their own time?
Originalism. Well, it's widely misunderstood, I think. Originalism is a part of textualism, and textualism is simply the idea that judges are interpreting words, words of a constitution, words of a statute, not hyperliterally, not narrowly, and not expansively, but fairly. Now, originalism is a subset of textualism that simply says you attribute to words the meaning that an intelligent user of the language would have attributed to them at the time of enactment. So one example that Justice Scalia and I liked to use, and was one that I devised, but he was kind of fond of it, was, let's say there's a statute that says all Nimrods in Texas, it's a 1927 statute, all Nimrods in Texas must carry a license. Now, What is a Nimrod? And do we attribute the modern meaning of Nimrod or the traditional meaning of Nimrod? Today, if you ask most people what is a Nimrod, they would say it's a dummy, a doofus, a simpleton, a nincompoop. But in 1927, the only thing that it meant was a hunter. And the reason it changed its meaning, and language often changes in very unpredictable ways, was Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny would pop out of his hole and say to Elmer Fudd, Nimrod, in a very derogatory voice. So are we to say if somebody challenges the statute today, saying that given its modern meaning, a Nimrod is somebody who's intellectually disabled, and this statute violates equal protection by suggesting that people with low IQs must carry licenses, that's an absurd interpretation. That's not a real interpretation, but there are lots of examples. Should words have a steady meaning? And in fact, it was completely uncontroversial, originalism, until probably the 1960s or 70s when law professors especially around the United States, started encouraging judges to attribute modern meanings to words that were not traditionally associated with those terms.
One thing that Scalia really advocated for throughout his years on the court was what are called bright line distinctions in law, the idea that laws should be very explicit, and it was not a good idea to leave statutes open to interpretation by anyone. Can you talk a little bit about how his insistence on this and the way that he rendered decisions based on that belief, did it have an effect on the way laws were written?
Well, I think it almost certainly has, although empirically that's probably a hard proposition to test. But he certainly did believe in bright line tests. He believed in clear law. He did not like fuzzy, multi-factor tests, all of which will lead ultimately to the explosion of litigation and to costly litigation. We're supposed to have a justice system in this country that can render justice without undue expense. And the more judges create fuzzy multi-factor tests, well, it could go this way, it could go that way, then the more problematic it is for our entire legal culture and the more costly litigation becomes.
I was really interested reading more about Justice Scalia this weekend than I had in the past to discover that there are people who have read his opinion simply for pleasure. People outside the community of legal scholars that you travel in. What was it that made him such a compelling writer?
Well, that's a mysterious thing. His father was a professor of Romance languages at Brooklyn College, and a great scholar himself. And I think his father helped imbue Justice Scalia with this love of language. I like to say, fall in love with language, it will love you back. Well, the English language certainly loved Justice Scalia back. And he was very eloquent. But we would work together in his chambers, sometimes a couple of days on end. And I would watch words appear on his computer screen as we were working through a difficult passage in reading law or making your case. And it's just something you cannot explain. How does he have this command of metaphor? How does he have this well-stocked mind full of literary turns of phrase? It's impossible to know. But I suspect he read very widely as a young man, and that his parents really encouraged articulate, thoughtful explanations of ideas, and were probably very bold in their use of metaphor and simile.
But he wasn't above very folksy expressions like jiggery pokery and argle bargle and pure applesauce. Do you think he labored at all over how much to include phrases like that?
Well, he did not find writing easy. I mean, that's the funny thing. You would think that somebody with this gift of eloquence would find writing to be a very easy task. In fact, both books, after we undertook them, he kind of wanted to back out because he said, this is very, very difficult. And for him, writing was hard. But then again, I think of something that Thomas Mann, the novelist, said, that a writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people. And I think that was true of Justice Scalia.
What do you know about what he read, unrelated to his work?
Well, not a lot. Not a whole lot. He was not... I'm sort of a book hoarder myself, and he knew that, and he would frequently pass on books to me that had been given to him. He liked to read the current news. I do know that one thing he read daily was his Catholic Missal, M-I-S-S-A-L, mm-hmm. because I had it rebound for him a couple of times because he would wear it out. But he had his daily prayers that he would read, and he read every day in Latin. So I think the Latin that he was so good at and reading every day was a very big influence on his use of language.
My guest is attorney, lexicographer, and author Brian Garner, who co-wrote two books with Justice Antonin Scalia. We're talking about the legacy of Justice Scalia in this part of the show. Later on, we'll talk about the politics and process of filling his vacant seat on the Supreme Court. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with attorney and lexicographer Brian Garner. He was a longtime writing collaborator with the late Justice Antonin Scalia. They shared writing credits on two books, Making Your Case and Reading Law. We are talking about the legacy of Justice Scalia in this part of the show. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Justice Scalia, Brian, was known to have some dear friendships with unlikely people, not least of which was the very progressive Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. First of all, let's hear what she had to say about him.
As annoyed as you might be about his zinging dissent, he is so utterly charming, so amusing, so sometimes outrageous. Maybe you can't help but saying, I'm glad that he's my friend or he's my colleague.
And they were more than colleagues. They vacationed together. They spent a lot of time together. They went to the opera together.
They spent every New Year's Eve together.
Help us understand this.
Well, to some degree, friendships are not, well, to a great degree, friendships are sort of visceral. You're just attracted to another person for all kinds of good qualities a person may have. I think it often has little to do with ideology. And you can be, if you're a very thoughtful person, you can be very close friends with somebody who doesn't agree with you on matters political, or in this instance, really judicial philosophy.
When you and Justice Scalia were spending time together that wasn't directly related to a project that you were working on, what did he want to talk about besides law or language?
Well, he was on our trip, for example, to Asia. And when he first arrived in Dallas 3 weeks ago, very much concerned about his wife, Maureen. And he just got the last flight out before the big blizzard. What was it? 3 weeks ago, Friday. Mm-hmm. And first thing he said was, I made a big fire for Maureen and was sure that she had the backup power source ready just in case. And he was concerned about the blizzard in his hometown in Virginia, just wanting to be sure that Maureen was all right. But he was such a wonderful family man. He once said to me, he said, Brian, you know, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. And he took family very seriously. And so we would talk about things like that. He liked to tell jokes. He loved to tell jokes. He, of course, was an outdoorsman. One thing we didn't do together is hunt. He was a big hunter, and I'm not. And when he first arrived here in Dallas, whenever he arrived, he would stay with us a couple of nights from time to time. We would, we were both foodies, and so we like fine restaurants, and I like to take him to my favorite haunts, and we enjoyed literature. We'd look at books together. I don't know. We tried to do regular guy things. When he was here just recently, first thing I told him is, I think you need a haircut. He said, are you serious? I said, well, we're going to Asia for 2 weeks. I do think you need a haircut. And I'm saying this partly selfishly because I need a haircut. And so I suggested that there was a great place that I knew he could get a good haircut. And the U.S. Marshal who went over to reserve the chair, Ivan's chair at Lover's Lane Barbershop, it really kind of spooked Ivan, I'm afraid. But the justice got a great haircut. But I was wondering a little bit, what are we going to do all day together? Because we can't work on book manuscripts all day. And we just kind of hung out and talked. And he was he was an extraordinary man, but in many ways, a very ordinary man.
Was it his intention to pull the court to the right, including the conservative members of the court?
No. And I don't believe he believed in horse trading. I think he wanted to persuade people of the justness of his thinking and the rightness of his thinking. But it's not as if he was trying to pull and push particular members of the court in particular ways. He often said, I write my dissents for law students. If I'm dissenting, it means I've lost. I'm writing for the law students. I want to capture their hearts and minds in the hope that the law can be clarified in a future day, given that what I think is the better view is not prevailing today.
What did he want to know about your politics before he decided to work with you?
Nothing.
And I don't actually know about your politics, so...
You know, I try to keep my politics... I'm a very apolitical guy. But in the end, he knew that I'm a libertarian Republican. And we talked about this. I mean, even in reading law, here was a man that a lot of people mischaracterize as being ideologically driven. He's co-authoring a book with a co-author who would just as soon not have a Second Amendment. Of course, that's not going to happen, so my views really are irrelevant, but he knew that I'm not a big fan of guns and that I favor gun control. He knew that on balance, that on many social issues, I am much more progressive, and that didn't bother him a whit. I didn't have to pass any kind of test. He knew that we both approach language similarly. In fact, despite our political differences, we haven't found a case involving statutory construction in which we disagree. And I also believe that the Heller decision on the Second Amendment is exactly right. Justice Scalia was correct about that. Much as I may regret the Second Amendment,
this is let me interrupt you. This is District of Columbia v. Heller, and this was the decision that ultimately decided that Americans have an individual right to bear arms.
Yeah. He was exactly right in that opinion, in my view, historically. I think it's bad policy. I mean, if I could time travel and go back to the founders, I would probably try to talk them out of the Second Amendment. But we daydreamed about this the other day. If we could time travel and go back to the founders for, let's say, 5 minutes, and we're back there in the 1780s, what would we try to talk them out of? And we agreed that we would both try to get them to make the Constitution easier to amend. He worked it out. He said that it would be possible for 2% of the American population to prevent a constitutional amendment from going through. And that is simply way too high a bar for us to have. And that's why ultimately a lot of lawyers and others have requested that the court amend the Constitution. It's too hard for the people to amend it, so we get the U.S. Supreme Court to amend it every few years.
There were times when his convictions led him to decisions in support of actions and ideas that he abhorred, not least of which is the right to free expression extends to the right to burn a flag if you want to protest the country, the government.
Well, he certainly believed that any good judge should not be enthusiastic about every decision, and that judges should, not infrequently, end up with a decision that goes against their own personal grain about what would be the best policy. And I heard him just 2 weeks ago say in Singapore that if he were king, he would make a rule that if you burn a flag, you'd be locked up for a very long time. But he's not king. He's a judge. There is a First Amendment. And as much as he considers it abhorrent to burn the flag, that is protected free speech.
In his dissent in Lawrence v. Texas, he famously, you know, made the prediction that this would open the door to legalizing same-sex marriage in this country. He didn't say that like, oh, great, this is coming down the road. He was sort of predicting doom and gloom. Is this anything you talk to him about, his ideas about this, which today feel like they are very different from a lot of Americans with regard to the rights of same-sex couples to be with the person they choose?
Well, the court, of course, has changed that. Whatever you think about the policy of it, Justice Scalia was often prophetic in his dissents. If you go this far, if you now say this statute is unconstitutional, the next step is to say that it's going to be a constitutional right. And so he correctly foresaw Obergefell in his Lawrence dissent. And the passion there was not about homophobia. Some people have used that word in reference to Justice Scalia, and it's very unfair because the passion was about separation of powers and how this should be decided. Justice Scalia believed in government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not government of the courts and by the courts. And so it was the passion that people sensed in those dissents was, how is this being decided and why are we doing an end run around democracy? If we're going to amend the Constitution, there's a way to do it.
When he would write these stinging dissents, was it personal to him?
He certainly had very strong convictions about proper judicial decision-making and what's legitimate and what's not legitimate. And he was a man of strong convictions and passions. And I think that carried through into every aspect of his life, whether he was playing tennis or whether he was out hunting or whether he was writing a passage in a book. He wanted to do it right, and he wanted, if it's a competitive sport, he wanted to win.
Tennis was one of the things he had in common with the late David Foster Wallace. And aside from your many accomplishments, one of the things you'll go down in history for is being the man who brought Antonin Scalia and David Foster Wallace together.
Yeah, that was an unlikely thing. My own friendship with David Foster Wallace was unlikely enough, but he wrote a long essay about one of my books, Modern American Usage, in his Consider the Lobster. And then we became friends, and David and I saw each other a few times. And when I heard that after David had moved to Claremont College and Justice Scalia was giving a talk at Claremont just after we began our first collaboration, I told him, because I knew that Scalia liked the David Foster Wallace essay on authority and American usage, that I suggested that Scalia's secretary should call the president of Claremont College and be sure that David Foster Wallace and his wife would be involved in whatever luncheon was going on. And that actually happened. And David told me later, he said, you know, I really like Justice Scalia. I expected not to like him because my politics are so different from his. But he's such a likable, charming man. And everybody was disarmed by how charming Justice Scalia was.
He was known to hire a liberal law clerk every term, which might surprise people. Do you know anything about how that clerk was used in his offices and sort of what the role was of having one liberal clerk every term?
I think that happened early in his judicial career, and that actually faded. But he liked to have this counterpoint. He liked to bandy around ideas. He liked to know what the weaknesses were in his own arguments. And of course, Justice Ginsburg has said that Justice Scalia made her arguments better by pointing out where the pure applesauce was and so on. But in the end, I think he came to the view that that academia, legal academia, is so far to the left in this country, and he is giving these law clerks such an advantage by having them be his clerks for a year, and it is an advantage for anyone who is a U.S. Supreme Court clerk. In fact, the clerks, when they move on from the clerkship, their bonuses and their annual salary, each of those, the bonus and the annual salary, will exceed what the justices would make in a year. In any event, a lot of them go on to become law professors, and I think he decided, why should I be advantaging some lefty, as he would occasionally say, and why should I not try to promote people with a mindset that's more like my own?
So he was somewhat motivated by ideology.
Well, I think he didn't want to have former clerks going out and trying to sabotage his own legacy. And that's an understandable thing, but that's an ideology. Textualism is an ideology. The idea that judges are not philosopher kings and that they are bound by the words of a text. That's an ideology. It's a good one.
Did he have retirement plans that he discussed with you?
No.
I know that you had future projects in the pipeline. Will they continue even now? Is it too soon to say?
Well, I think certainly the second editions of Reading Law and Making Your Case are well along and essentially finished in the case of Reading Law. I was helping him put together his speeches, for example. What will happen there, I don't know. In one of our last conversations, we talked about his unfinished literary work and what I would be doing to help him there. But I think these are matters for the family to sort out.
Brian Garner is an attorney, teacher, lexicographer, and longtime writing collaborator with Justice Antonin Scalia. They co-authored the books Making Your Case, The Art of Persuading Judges, and Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Texts. Brian, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thank you.
Coming up next, UNT Dallas Law School Dean Royal Ferguson, a retired U.S. District Judge, joins us to talk about the politics and process of filling the Supreme Court seat left open by Justice Scalia's death.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As a practical matter, the death of Justice Antonin Scalia leaves the Supreme Court short one justice and effectively balanced between four liberals and four conservatives. In almost the same breath with public condolences to his family, American politicians expressed opinions on whether President Obama should nominate a replacement for Scalia or that such a critical position should be delayed until the next president takes office just under a year from now. Not surprisingly, those opinions are sharply divided along political lines as lawmakers ponder the possibility of a court with a liberal rather than conservative majority. Joining us to talk about the politics and process of nominating and confirming a successor to Scalia's Supreme Court seat is retired U.S. District Judge and founding dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law, Royal Ferguson. Judge, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much.
We are at an unusual moment in history with just eight jurists on the court until a replacement has been confirmed for Justice Scalia. He's only the third to die in office since 1954. How does the Supreme Court function when there are only eight justices present to render decisions?
Well, they continue to function, Chris, but they may not be able to decide certain cases. In every term, there are what we call sort of hot-button issues. There are certainly those issues before the court right now. In fact, two of them have been argued. And if the court cannot decide, then the lower court decisions remain in effect, and the issue stays open until the Supreme Court can revisit it in another case at another time.
And the reason they go through the exercise is that theoretically there could be a 5-3 split or a 6-2 split.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
What are the arguments for and against President Obama making a nomination in the 11 months he's still in office, as opposed to holding off and saving that selection for the next president?
I think the arguments for it are that the Supreme Court plays an incredibly important role in our system of governments. And to be waiting for 11 months and then get a new president and probably wait another 10 or 11 months, it could be almost 2 years where so much of the work of the federal courts sort of becomes gridlocked on hold. And I don't think that's really good for us. Of course, it depends on your viewpoint as to what you think President Obama might do. I really think that it would be well to move forward if possible. What I would hope, this is just my hope, is that this would encourage President Obama to perhaps look at somebody who we know is really middle of the road, sort of has a balanced kind of perspective about things, maybe a legislator, which would be interesting, who has to work with colleagues and balance and compromise and so forth. I think that would perhaps be a real plus if he would reach somewhere into our legal system and find such a person, maybe like Sandra Day O'Connor, who had such a very balanced approach to her jurisprudence. If he did that, maybe that would be an encouragement to the Senate to think about letting someone like that onto the court.
Does a name come to mind when you talk about a legislator and you've got this sort of list of qualifications? It sounds like you know just the right person.
Well, I wish I did. A name doesn't come to mind. One name that kind of popped into my mind early on was the retired Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, Wallace Jefferson. Wallace, as you know, was served on our court as a Republican, but I think had a jurisprudence that was balanced, was a little conservative, but was very balanced. So I thought about Chief Justice Jefferson. I couldn't come up with an idea on a legislator. It wouldn't even have to be a national legislator. Of course, Sandra Day O'Connor came from the state legislative bench. But I would love to see someone that would come and look for a balanced kind of approach to these difficult questions. I love Aristotle's golden mean, which is stay away from the edges, take the middle path. And if we could find somebody that was working in the golden mean, I think it would be really a benefit to our whole government.
By and large, the Supreme Court has had a conservative majority since the early 70s, right? The Nixon administration. How different do you think the country would be, and how long would it take to feel a difference were there to be a progressive majority?
I think you would feel it pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I think you would. And it may be that President Obama would feel that he needed to put a progressive on the court. I think if he did that, the chances that that nominee would go forward would be pretty slim. I think the only way he could hope to perhaps get something accomplished would be with a moderate, middle-of-the-road judicial philosophy.
I was looking this up. The confirmation process certainly can be lengthy, but it's rarely taken more than 3 months, right? The longest in modern history being Clarence Thomas. He was confirmed after 99 days. Robert Bork's nomination was rejected after 114. Is there any reason to believe a timely appointment by President Obama could not be confirmed by the time he leaves office?
This is a pretty difficult moment in our politics.
But when are they easy, Judge?
Right. When are they easy? I don't think there's any question that he'll make an appointment, that he will make a nomination. I don't think there's any question he'll do that. And then the question will be whether there's some effort to reach across the aisle and look for somebody that has a more moderate philosophy, neither progressive nor conservative. I think that would be a winning combination. But nobody's called me yet.
Understandably, many conservatives are hoping that the next president will be a Republican, and therefore they want that president who shares their political values to be the one to make this nomination. Are there any Democrats, any liberals that you know of who are arguing for waiting, hoping that a Hillary Clinton or a Bernie Sanders would make that choice?
I know of none. Mm-hmm. There may be some, but I know of none.
There have been, there's always a pipeline, right? There's the D.C. Circuit Court, and there's usually a candidate or two
right.
there.
And Chris, could I interrupt you a minute?
Sure.
When we talk about Obama making the nomination and getting it through, because normally the time period is, as you say, about 3 months, there is one historical moment that we would need to think about, and that was Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy, I think, there were two people nominated before Justice Kennedy. They were both rejected by the Senate, and then Justice Kennedy was nominated. So that period of time, I don't know how long that took, but I'm sure that went into six or 8 months.
If you combine the two.
If you combine the two, that was a Nixon appointee, a President Nixon appointee. So there is a precedent where the person could be rejected. And if that's the case, then you would roll over to another nominee and another nominee.
I think it's reasonable to say that lawmakers from both parties might consider politics when deciding how critically to view a nominee that is from the opposite party. Can you talk a little bit about the ethics of this? In your opinion, when is it appropriate to object to a nominee, and when is it something that should be left up to the president, whether Republican or Democrat?
Well, that's a great question. And, Lindsey Graham, for example, is a good example. Lindsey Graham certainly, for example, didn't agree with Justice Kagan or Justice Sotomayor, but he voted for them because he felt they were very competent and very able, and they were entitled to be considered because the president had nominated them. So the president had that role. So a conservative, Lindsey Graham, decided he had the obligation, if he looked at these people and found them competent and able and strong as potential people on the Supreme Court, that he needed to give the president that deference. There are other people that don't agree so much with that, and President Obama might be another example, because you remember he didn't vote for Justice now Chief Justice Roberts for several reasons. And the argument can be made that Chief Justice Roberts is going to be one of the great chief justices, no matter how you feel about him and his viewpoints, that he's protected the court as an institution. He, for example, voted twice for the Affordable Care Act when the more conservative elements of the court rejected that vote. I think he's been a great justice. And President Obama didn't give the requisite deference to him when he was a U.S. senator. So President Obama may be asking people to forget that example of his and really give him more deference. It's going to come down to each senator and how each senator views it. Lindsey Graham is my example of an appropriate position on the matter.
Could a liberal majority, if there were one, and I realize that this is hardly a foregone conclusion even with a Democrat in the White House right now, could a liberal majority go back and change any of the outcomes of cases like Citizens United that have been so unpopular with American progressives?
It's a good chance they could. It's a good chance that the Congress could try to pass more election reform, and that a different court could take a different view than Citizens United. So I remember Justice Frankfurter once said when he voted for an opinion in a case where he had held the contrary view, written a different opinion earlier, and he voted to overturn himself. And in his concurrence, he said, "Wisdom too often never comes, but one ought not reject it merely because it comes late." And so they do have that power to really change precedent. We hope that they will be very careful about that because we really need a very kind of firm view of how things stand, although there are many people that argue the Citizens United was not the right result.
How did the court change in the 30 years, nearly 30 years, that Justice Scalia was a member?
He had an enormous impact and probably will go down as one of the most impactful justices that ever sat on the court. His view of originalism swung the court some. His view of textualism swung the court some. In fact, today, almost through the entire federal judiciary, if you have a case involving a statute, the first thing you're going to do is look at the text. You're not going to look at the legislative history. You're going to look at the text. If the text seems pretty clear, then you're going to go with the text.
To interrupt, it doesn't matter what lawmakers may or may not have meant. What matters is what they wrote down in
exactly.
That law.
Exactly. And you might have 10 lawmakers saying, we meant this. But the statute says something besides this. And most judges now, I think, both at the state and federal level, are going to go with what was said, not necessarily what was meant. Now, there's strong argument that if you get into ambiguity, then you try to figure out meaning. And there's also strong argument that if by going with the text you actually destroy what seems to be the clear meaning, then you got to be balanced about how you proceed. But Justice Scalia's emphasis on the text, I think in many ways, has carried the day, at least as a starting point, not maybe as an ending point, but clearly as a starting point.
How do you think the process of selecting and nominating the next Supreme Court justice will be a subject of discussion for law students who are currently scholars of the law in America today?
Oh, I think this is going to be a great learning experience for law students. I don't have any doubt that this will be a great teaching opportunity, no doubt at all. It in some ways, it's sad. This very vibrant and energetic and smart man who meant so much to our jurisprudence. It's a sadness that we lose him. Really, it seems at still the height of his powers. It's a very sad thing, and we should remember to give condolences to his family and his friends. I know Brian Garner is a very close friend. So we've lost a giant of the judiciary, and we ought to pause a minute to remember that. But of course, life goes on, and all these matters are going to come to the fore.
Judge Royal Ferguson is a retired U.S. District Judge and founding dean of the UNT Dallas College of Law. Judge, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Alex Smith, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.